From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Wes Craven. He directs horror movies, like the cult favorites Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes, and the box office success Nightmare on Elm Street. Also today, I talk with Duane Eddy, whose twangy guitar helped define the early sound of rock and roll. Eddy has recorded his first new album in a decade. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the DBs, a group long popular in England, which is now attracting an audience in the United States. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Raw, the new movie of comic Eddie Murphy in concert. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Wes Craven is one of today's top horror film directors. His credits include Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Deadly Friend. Craven compares movie watching to dreaming. He said, when people go into a theater and they shut off the lights, it's as if they're entering the darkness of sleep and dreams. To me, a good horror film should be just that, a compelling dream. Craven's first film, Last House on the Left, advanced the genre to a new level of gruesome violence. It graphically and realistically depicted two teenage girls being raped, tortured, and killed by psychotic escaped convicts. The film truly horrified not only viewers, but industry insiders. Though it became a cult classic, it didn't win Craven contracts for major motion pictures. He made several more small genre films, which were praised by some critics for their eccentricity and ironic edge, and for how deeply felt his vision was. The box office success of Nightmare on Elm Street has allowed Craven to start to move beyond the genre. His new film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, is a suspense thriller scheduled to open in early February. The movie is set in Haiti and is based on the true story of a Harvard student who investigated the scientific basis of voodoo magic. I spoke to Wes Craven from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked him why he started to make horror movies, if he loved the genre, or if he just saw it as a way to break into the film industry.
As a matter of fact, I wasn't aware of the genre. I was simply trying to break into the film business, as everyone else is, waitresses and all. And a horror film was the first sort of film that was presented to me as an opportunity. I had no knowledge of them before that. I really did not. I was more immersing myself in the work of the European directors and the Fellinis and Bergmans and so forth. But I found I had an affinity for it that even surprised me. I didn't know until I started doing it that I could do it rather well.
So you were approached to do The Last House on the Left?
Yeah, that's right. I was working, just learning the film business. I was literally in the business about a year and a half from not knowing a thing about it. And I was working my way up through the editing room and got an opportunity to work on a small feature that allowed me to do some directing, some writing, and some editing at a point where I knew virtually nothing about making a cut or writing the script. And that film was successful, and as a result, the producer, who was Sean Cunningham at that time, a very, very young guy who was also just starting, Sean was offered by the distributor the chance of making a horror film for them to fill their summer bill. And Sean offered me the chance to write it, direct it, and cut it. We were close friends. We were working out of one small office on 45th Street in New York, and the two of us were going to set off and make this film for a very small amount of money. We made it for $90,000. And our entire concept was to maybe clear $10,000 out of the budget to pay our own home bills. And instead, the film caused a sensation and took off at the box office, and we became sort of notorious. And I was in one swell swoop, a director of some sort.
Well, it caused a sensation because it was just so gruesome and realistic. You know, a lot of violence in horror movies is really very campy, and it doesn't really hurt. But the violence in Last House on the Left and the scenes of rape and mutilation and torture are so intense. I mean, I ended up walking out of the theater for that scene. I just felt that I didn't want to have to remember it if I saw it. And I wonder if that's the challenge that you took on for yourself, to make something more graphic and more realistic than it had ever been done before.
It was. It was very specifically the philosophy of it. You know, I had a certain ambivalence towards doing this sort of genre. As I said, it was not something that I loved. But I was intrigued by the idea of presenting anything that was exceptionally truthful, because I felt that most of the films that I'd seen that were made in America for popular audiences were distortions, and they quite often would present violence in a way that was either operatic or balletic or simply elliptic, so that, you know, you would fade away before any true violence was done, or the act of violence would be very simple and antiseptic. Someone would be shot, clutch his chest, and fall down and die. A stab wound, you know, always killed with the first thrust. And parallel to the process of filmmaking, in my own mind and in the minds of Sean too, were the mass of media inputs from the Vietnam War, and where we were seeing the first results of ourselves and the whole American public being exposed to the realities of war on a sort of real-time basis. Whereas you saw people suffered. It wasn't edited. The government didn't have enough facilities to filter it all out, so that we were seeing reality of violence on our television sets, going into our theaters and seeing distorted, filtered reality. So that Sean and I set off to say simply, let's not cut away, and let's not do violence that is entertaining. And I didn't. You know, I simply did not cut away. And one stab did not do it, and one shot did not do it. And at the time that most other movies would cut away so people could safely ensconce themselves in the next scene and sort of forget about the reality of it, we kept going. And we did that within the format of a B-movie. Now, you know, we were two pretty mature men. We were 30 when we did this. We were not kids. We had a very real plan in mind. We were working within the basis of a B-movie, very almost cartoonish characters. But once the violence began, the violence was treated absolutely really. And thus the outrage. The audiences were, in a sense, tricked. They went into a movie expecting to be entertained in the pure action or horror sense, where the blood is ketchup and the violence is simple and cartoonish. And instead, we said, now that we've got you here, by the way, this is what violence is really like.
What's the benefits of seeing that, though?
I think the benefits of seeing that is that it reaffirms reality rather than reaffirming a fantasy. Too much of American cinema dealt with reaffirming fantasies. It was a Disney-like approach to the entire spectrum of our reality. And at the same time, in the real world, quote, whatever the hell that is, we were seeing more and more of the veils stripped away, you know. The myth of American supremacy and infallibility, the myth of, you know, bombs dropped to win wars and you don't see the people that they hit, the reality that the American soldier was heroic and in all cases and never did anything that was terribly disturbing. All those were being stripped away in the public forum, but in cinema, we're still desperately trying to reaffirm the myths. And my feeling was it's time to stop dreaming. And I guess that's become the theme of my entire work. It's time to wake up.
I think in some ways that Last House on the Left became a forerunner of slasher films. And I wonder if you think that other film directors have taken the kind of graphic violence that you started to extremes that you find disturbing.
Well, I don't think it really was a forerunner to slasher films. I mean, there were the films of Stuart Gordon a long time before I made Last House. I think it more or less stands on its own. I mean, the genre in the sense of, you know, a man with a knife has been around. Hitchcock did it. And, you know, Hitchcock always boasted that you never saw the knife touch the flesh. Well, in my mind, as good as Hitchcock was, and I would never deny his genius, he denied the essence of the moment. And I always go on, there was a French philosopher that once said, it's all right to lie. That's what art is all about. But it's not all right to lie about the essence of the matter. And I've used that as my credo making films.
So you don't think that other people have taken what you've done to extremes that disturb you?
No, I don't. I don't think other people are that weak or, you know, are artistic Xeroxes. I think everybody goes off and does their own vision, and I don't take responsibility for other people's work. Frankly, it's bad enough taking responsibility for my own.
Well, has that been hard? I mean, really, have people made false assumptions about you based on your movies?
I don't know whether they're false or true. I mean, you know, sometimes the truth hurts too. But I certainly have had my experiences of people getting up and walking away, not only from my movies, but from me. You know, I was anathema in polite society after I made Last House. People literally would grab their children and run from the room. And I always found it an irony that, you know, the same people that would support a war or, you know, live a lifestyle that would require entire third world countries to be put in near slavery would at the same time be appalled by somebody that did something that was only effective within a certain closed dark room called a movie house. It was very interesting.
Director,
but, yes, I've experienced a great deal of, you know, ostracism from making of films. It wasn't. It's only been in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years that I've received real nice things from it.
Director Wes Craven is my guest. You know, it seems to me that although you started doing this very almost documentary style portrayals of violence, that the violence in your movies has gotten more movie-like.
Mm-hmm.
In, for instance, Nightmare on Elm Street and Deadly Friend. I don't know if you'd agree with that. But
I would agree with it in the sense that, you know, I've thought about it myself. I could give you lots of artistic reasons, but I've also wondered whether, as Lena Wertmüller once said, the one thing the artist must never lose is his rage. Maybe I've lost some of my rage. I don't know. I think Last House was specifically about real violence. I don't think of that film as a horror film. I think of horror films as sort of about not real life, you know, about the area of fantasy and dreams. Last House was about real violence that people really do to each other. And the capacity for it within the most staid, middle-classed breast. And that was why the tables turned in that movie. And at the end, the parents were just as violent as the escaped psychopaths, you know. The later films, Nightmare on Elm Street, for instance, was much more about psychic consciousness, I'm not into some sort of weird cult, or I'm a very ordinary guy, but, you know, I feel very much like the real stakes that are going on in the planet insofar as humankind is concerned is consciousness. Are we going to be awake or are we going to be asleep? And the only way to get rid of the boogeyman is to stay awake, not to fall asleep, not to try to dream him away.
Yeah, that's what happens in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Everyone's warned not to fall asleep because this group of teenagers share the same nightmare. They have this nightmare of a mutilated killer who attacks them in their dreams. But the attacks that he carries out in their dreams carry over into their real life. So when they're stabbed in their sleep, they bleed in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Is this in a way the fulfillment of your theory that horror films are like nightmares?
Well, I think it's more like I think our dreams become our realities. I carry it much more into waking life.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as our most subtle and unbounded imagination produces things, we must deal with them within real life. And insofar as we neglect them, whether they be horrific thoughts or tendencies or impulses or whatever, so to the extent that we neglect them and try to go off into the various exits that the characters in Nightmare used, except for the heroine, that is, sex, booze, you know, family, solidity, whatever it might be, all those people were denying the reality and saying, you know, this is reality. Only one person was willing to face it, and that is the only person that survived. So I'm saying, you know, not that, you know, nightmares are like dreams. It's our dreams must be dealt with. Our most innermost uncensored impulses must be dealt with, must be worked out in real life, within our lives. And that's, you know, to me, the thrill of making films for a young audience is that I am sort of writing scenarios for the apocalypse. You know, I'm dealing with very primal, raw energies and trying to put some form on them. And I really, truly believe that that is, as much as anything else, why my audience likes my films. Not that they're just bloody and scary, although that is a thrill, but that they have some inner sense to them. They've been thought through, and they are not black. They're strangely hopeful. You know, my characters survive not because of some fluke of luck, but they survive because they figure out what's going on and they figure out a way to deal with it within the capacities of their human spirit. And they have to plumb to the very depths of it and come up with the best and the brightest of it. You know, Nancy doesn't kill Freddy at the end of Nightmare on Elm Street by picking up a bigger gun or inventing Star Wars. She kills him by turning her back on him, you know. And that's a pretty subtle and, I think, profound thought. It's not one that I came up with, you know. It's one that I found in my own readings and listenings. But, you know, it's an important notion.
I want to talk more about your movies, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is film director Wes Craven. His movies include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Deadly Blessing, and Nightmare on Elm Street. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is film director Wes Craven, who's joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. You said earlier on in our conversation that you initially didn't want to get into horror movies. It was just your way of getting into the film industry. Now that you've had some big successes like Nightmare on Elm Street, are you trying to get out of that genre?
Well, I would love for people to say, filmmaker Wes Craven instead of horror film director. So to the extent that I would like to feel less bounded, that I could have people come to me with projects that are not considered a horror film, that's important to me. I hate being restricted by myself, by other people's concept of me. So, yeah, I would like to get out of horror films. I would never have liked to have been in them. I don't like my films, as I said, classified as horror films, per se. They're films. They're Wes Craven films.
You know, well, Wes Craven, you are from, I understand, from a fundamentalist Baptist background, and you had a pretty strict upbringing. And
oh, well, that explains it all, doesn't it?
No. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you. No.
I'm smiling.
No, okay. No, but I wonder, you know, if... it does seem to me, however, that you did kind of get a chance to unleash some pent-up feelings when you got into the horror film genre. I mean, for a man who didn't even get to see any movies till he was in college, you really went at it once you got into them yourself.
That's true. And I'm sure that did have a very profound influence on my energies and mind. You know, it's a lifestyle. I mean, I don't want to defame any religion or religious posture, but it is one based on... a view of the world that is very dark, very prescriptive, proscriptive, and, can leave you with a tremendous sense of rage once you're out of it, because you feel like you've been denied your youth, your joy. To religion, this is all of our righteousness is like filthy rags. I mean, if you look at yourself like that, you have a very dark view of yourself, and you have a very dark, almost throwaway view of the entire world. And it's something that I've had to grow out the rest of my life, grow out of, you know.
What made you fall in love with movies when you started to see them?
They're so beautiful. I don't know. I always had an active dream life, and there's something so profound and wonderful about a movie. It's so alive. It's so shared. The thing of sitting in an audience and going into a dreamlike state with several hundred other people that are sharing exactly what you're feeling is a profound event. I think it's really, to me, it simply was something that nothing else quite did for me. And it also was something that I proved after many years of sort of searching for a voice. I mean, I did many things in my life. I painted and I played guitar and wrote and did many, many things. But it all seemed to come together in making movies, and almost accidentally. I was pursuing a career in writing and went to New York to make movies almost out of desperation of finding something that I really felt happy at. And all of a sudden, I just was good at it really fast. I made my first feature, a year and a half after not knowing anything about making a movie whatsoever. It simply was there, and I was there, and we crossed, and it was love at first sight between me and movies.
You're working on a new film now, The Serpent and the Rainbow, that's based on a book of the same name, about a Harvard graduate student who goes down to Haiti and uncovers what he thinks is the biological secret behind zombies. At least
yes.
That's what the book was about. I haven't seen the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So you were shooting on location in Haiti, and can't think of many films that have been shot there. There's been a lot of political upheaval there lately. Did that affect the making of the film at all?
Yes. First of all, let me just a thumbnail the movie. Wade Davis was a Harvard ethnobotanist, and he was commissioned by a large pharmaceutical company in a rather secret expedition to go to Haiti and find the sort of botanical reason behind the creation of zombies. And I just wanted to say about zombies, I mean, as soon as you say the word, you think B-movies and think of, you know, Boris Karloff or whatever. Recently, several zombies have been discovered. That is, people who were authenticated having died and been buried and later found alive. I personally met one, 17-year-old zombie, quote, by the name of Rosemary. What they are, as it turned out after extensive research, is people that have been poisoned by a very subtle, very powerful neurotoxin that gives them all appearances of death. Their heartbeat, their respiration, and all other vital signs go down to the point where they cannot be determined by a typical rural doctor. The person is buried, and in the middle of the night is still alive, still fully conscious, although showing no signs of life, is dug back up, further poisoned, beaten, and quite often sold into slavery in Haiti and for the work in the cane fields, all part of a tribal system of judgment. It's their form of capital punishment within voodoo. So rather than thinking of zombies, think of somebody who's been poisoned by a neurotoxin and appeared to be dead but was not and has then returned to the living as a brain-damaged person with all of their volitional centers destroyed. That is what a zombie truly is. And this movie is about that actual factual process. The process existed for centuries and then was distorted by Duvalier, Papa Doc Duvalier, and used as a tool of political oppression. If you spoke out too harshly against his government, you would be dragged from your house in the middle of the night and made into a zombie. And there could be no more compelling or terrifying symbol of the power of Duvalier than a person who wished for freedom suddenly turned into a zombie, which has no will whatsoever. So this movie is about that process, and it's quite a factual movie, but it's set within the world of real voodoo and, has that sort of phantasmagoric element to it, because voodoo goes very freely into the subconscious and into the netherworld between life and death.
What was it like filming in Haiti?
Filming in Haiti was bifold. I mean, on one hand, the Haitian people are some of the most beautiful and gracious people I've ever met. And taken individually, they're wonderful, marvelous people. Within a group of more than six or eight, they can very quickly develop a sense of outrage and wanting to tear the house down because they've been oppressed so severely. So that when we were dealing with large crowds, and we had some scenes dealing with 4,000 people, we ended up in very dangerous situations. We ended up once having to evacuate our crew into a missionary compound in a small village far removed from any help. And the producer and I had to go out and deal with 4,000 chanting, very angry people who were started picking up stones and threatened to destroy us and our equipment and everything else. I mean, they are very unhappy, rightfully so, people. And it was a very, a very volatile situation.
Were you perceived as the exploiter, as the filmmaker there?
Not at first. I mean, we went in with, with all attempts to say we are bringing work and jobs and everything else. But what happened is an unfortunate event of the people have been deprived for so long that that any show of money whatsoever becomes sort of what they perceive as the beginning of the gold mine opening up.
One last question. You know, a lot of your movies have probably are about dreams and have probably affected the dreams of the people who've gone to see them. And I wonder if your dreams are ever affected by the movies that you're making.
They always are. I mean, as I said, I have an active dream life, and I don't say that glibly. I, over the years, have developed my process of dreaming to the point that it is functional. And when I'm working on a script or a movie, that filters right down into my dreams, and I quite often dream quite intact and usable portions of films, sometimes quite sizable portions of films or scenes. And it was a natural progression as that developed for my films to get more and more into the dream state.
Can you give Nightmare us an example of a... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's just the concept of Nightmare on Elm Street came out of my own dreams. The whole structure of Hills of Eyes, for instance, came out of one dream.
What was the dream?
Well, the dream was specifically started with the concept of the two dogs, Beauty and the Beast. And from that spread out to a concept of... that there would be two forces represented in the film, that would be the bestial and the beautiful, and that they would intertwine to the extent that each family would mirror the other. There would be a father in each, there'd be a mother in each, there'd be children in each, there'd be pet animals in each. And at a certain point, the polarity would switch so that what was perceived as the good family would become the evil family, what was the gentle family would become the savage family. And vice versa, the savage family at certain points would take on pathos. And, you know, that concept of turning the duality around and around until you no longer felt comfortable thinking that there was a duality you could deal with and had to look at things in the round, that was the basic concept that came out of the dream. It was very clear-formed, and it became sort of the backbone of the structure of the film.
Do you ever have nightmares based on movies that you're working on? Do your movies ever scare you?
They scare me when I'm writing them. That's about the most alone that I ever get with them. The rest of the time is a process surrounded by so many people that you know, that you sort of lose that, and you have to struggle to maintain it so you can understand what will be scary in that gross sense. But when I'm writing, if I'm writing a scene where I'm right in the middle of it alone by myself in a dark room, somebody comes up behind me, I will jump right out of my seat because at that point they're full-blown, you know. While they're still in your mind, they're the most intact and the most powerful. By the time they get onto film, they're diminished by 10,000 factors, you know. They're still pretty scary, but you should see what's in my head.
Well, what is in your head?
I get paid for telling people that.
Ah, okay. Well, Wes Craven, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Wes Craven's films include The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and Nightmare on Elm Street. His new film, The Serpent and the Rainbow, is scheduled to open on February 5th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with choreographer Alwyn Nicolai. For more than 40 years, he's been a revolutionary in the world of dance, creating spectacles of light, motion, and music that he composes himself. So I hope you can join us. This is the main title theme from the soundtrack of Wes Craven's film A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, guitarist Duane Eddy talks about his early career when he created his twanging guitar style and his recent return to recording with his first U.S. album in a decade. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sound of Music, the new album from the DBs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Raw, featuring comic Eddie Murphy in concert. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. A powerful storm buried much of the southeast today under nearly a foot of snow and coated roads with ice. Schools and businesses were shut down. Many roads were closed. A state trooper in Mississippi said, "It looks like Utah out there." Up to 10 inches of snow fell in the mountains of North Georgia. Atlanta's Hartsfield International Airport remained open, but scores of flights were canceled or delayed. Now residents of the mid-Atlantic states are bracing for the worst as the storm heads up the east coast. The oil spill on the Ohio River is easing just a bit. It's shrunken in size, and officials like Pat Madigan of the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency say that ice on the river is slowing the diesel slick as it moves southward.
It could have been a lot worse. We're very fortunate.
Water engineers in East Liverpool, Ohio today succeeded in treating river water and avoided having to shut down the local water supply. It's the first time a waterworks has been successful in getting the fuel out. In the Pittsburgh area, residents got their first running water in 3 days, but the water supply to more than a million people in other communities is still threatened. Another Palestinian is dead after Israeli troops opened fire on rioters in the Gaza Strip today. That report from relief workers comes after Rhode Island Senator John Chafee was forced to flee from a Palestinian refugee camp on the West Bank after students threw rocks and Israeli soldiers fired tear gas. The altercation came less than a day after Chafee met with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, a meeting in which the Rhode Island Republican criticized the Israelis for using violence to quell Palestinian unrest. President Reagan plans to nominate William Burns to be director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. If confirmed by the Senate, Burns will replace Kenneth Edelman. But as NPR's Brian Naylor reports, Senate confirmation of Burns is not a sure thing.
The two ranking members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Democratic Chairman Claiborne Pell and Republican Jesse Helms, are expressing reservations about Burns' nomination. Pell believes the director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency should be a civilian. Burns, currently Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, is a major general on active duty in the Army. For Jesse Helms, the problem is of a different sort. Helms believes Burns is too soft on arms control, and according to the Washington Times, the North Carolina conservative plans a full-scale effort to block the nomination. The White House is standing behind its nominee. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today called Burns an outstanding candidate and said he is confident Burns will be confirmed. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci is in Saudi Arabia today. Few details about the visit are expected, but it does come at a time when Arab leaders around the Persian Gulf have expressed fear that the U.S. might cut its naval forces in the area. Secretary of State Shultz today gave the U.S. assessment of progress in putting into effect the regional peace program known as the Guatemala Plan. Central American leaders meet next week to give their view. Details from NPR's Ted Clark.
Secretary Shultz sees little prospect of Nicaragua complying with the peace plan. He said the country has not found a way to negotiate a ceasefire as the plan requires, and he complained that the Nicaraguan government has not taken other steps called for. It still has a state of emergency in force and many political prisoners in jail. Shultz expressed the hope that the Central American leaders will not gloss over problems like these when they assess the peace plan next week.
When the presidents gather, I hope they will describe the reality as it is. And while there is some progress, at least at this point in time, it still falls short, in my opinion. Maybe it'll change between now and then.
Unless all the conditions of the Guatemala plan are fully agreed to, the Reagan administration will go ahead and request more aid for the Contras, though Secretary Shultz would not say today how big the request would be. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 14 points to 2051.89. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from the DBs. It's called The Sound of Music. It's probably not the kind of music the Von Trapp family would have enjoyed. The DBs album cover pictures an older couple in their bedroom. She has her hands over her ears. He is banging on the ceiling with a broomstick, as if trying to get the DBs above to turn down the volume.
In 1978, a group of North Carolina expatriates living in New York City formed the DBs. The title of their first album, released in 1981, explained their name. Stands for Decibels, it was called. Since that time, the DBs have gone through numerous personnel changes, losing one of the band's two main songwriters in the process, but they still remain committed to making the sort of bright, tight rock songs that have made the DBs a cult favorite.
I was up, pacing the floor. She was on her way out of town and she wanted to know if I'd gone insane. Well, I might, but I doubt if that changes things. She said, yeah, you're right. So I hung up the phone cause I don't wanna hear what Molly says.
That's Molly Says from the new DBs album, The Sound of Music. One interesting aspect of the DBs material is that while the melodies are invariably up-tempo and catchy, the lyrics are often prickly, ambivalent, often downright downbeat. This is certainly true of the song Change with the Changing Times. It's about a fellow standing in New York's Grand Central Station preparing to leave the city after a breakup with his girlfriend. The DBs haven't had an easy time of it commercially. The band's first two albums weren't even released in America. They were issued in England to great acclaim. The DBs' third album, called Like This, found an American record company in 1984, but just as it was released, the company, Bearsville, went out of business. It's no wonder the band considers this new one, The Sound of Music, released by a solid American label, IRS, to be the first DBs album that really has a chance to be heard by a large number of people. The band's leader, Peter Holsapple, said recently, "This is our second album and our first fourth album." He said, "We're lucky that our fans have been as persistent as we have."
Me why I can't eat.
myself. One day soon I've got to go. I know I'll go to Bonneville. I'll see it there in front of me, behind of me, and beside of me. And the heat gets so dry, I get sand in my eyes. Maybe then I'll realize I'm in Bonneville. Bonneville.
That's Bonneville, the sort of immediately attractive rock song that leaves you wondering why the DBs aren't better known than they are. If you listen to the stuff that clutters up most rock radio stations, I suppose you can figure it out. The DBs sing with hoarse, conversational voices, and they aren't afraid to let their influences show. Country music on that song, for instance. At a time when the most successful rock music is a series of seamless creations whose sentiments comfort or complement the listener, the DBs are busy avoiding clichés. For almost a decade now, they've refused to pretend to be rebels or pin-up boys or spokesmen for their generation. They're just smart fellows making rock and roll.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist Duane Eddy was one of the first instrumentalists to become a rock and roll star. His records Rebel Rouser, Ramrod, and 40 Miles of Bad Road became big hits, and a lot of young guitarists tried to imitate his twanging guitar style. But in the 60s, when Duane Eddy's tunes dropped off the charts, he dropped out of sight. Now Duane Eddy's back. He's opened for Huey Lewis in the News, his hits from the 50s and 60s have been reissued on compact disc, and he's just released his first new album in a decade. As a teenager in Phoenix, Arizona, Duane Eddy was playing country music in local clubs. But in 1955, when Elvis Presley's music hit Phoenix, Eddy says it was easy to switch over to rock and roll.
I always said most rock and roll is country music with drums. And you had a drummer and maybe a saxophone player, too, in those days, and you were doing rock and roll.
I read somewhere that some of your early records were cut in a studio that didn't have an echo chamber, so that you faked one.
Well, no, actually didn't fake it. What we did was we went out and bought a big several thousand gallon water tank and put a speaker in one end and a mic in the other, and that was our echo. And used to set outside the studio, and we'd have to go out and chase the birds off of it in the morning, which was great fun. And if a fire engine came by while we were in the middle of a take, that was it for that take. I mean, because it'd reverberate around through the tank.
Hit records of the themes from Peter Gunn and from Paladin. Was it your idea to record those?
Not Peter Gunn. That was the sax player, Steve Douglas. He came in one day and wanted to do it in an album. We were in the midst of our second album, and he had this idea. He'd worked it out on sax that he could do it, and I, I wasn't all that anxious to do it. There wasn't much for me to do at the time. But I did work out an ending, and an intro and the middle part and everything. So we did it for the album. And then Australia released it as a single, and it went to number 3 there. So Great Britain decided to release it as a single a few months later, and it went to their top 10. So finally America decided to, Jamie Records here has decided to release it, and it became a hit here as well.
You recently re-recorded the Peter Gunn theme. Why did you decide to do that, and did you do anything differently on it that you would have liked to do the first time around but couldn't?
No, this was an entirely different approach, entirely different record. This was with a group called The Art of Noise. And they're an English group, and very avant-garde, and a very big hit with the dance crowd these days. And they contacted me, and I fell in love with the idea. I thought it was great, because The Art of Noise has their own sound. I know it's very strange and unusual to some ears, but it is very distinctive, and I figured it might work, and it did.
Retire from music, and when did you first retire from music?
When my record stopped selling, I sort of retired. It was mandatory retirement. Although in 1970 I tried a record called Freight Train with Jimmy Bowen producing, and it got in the top 10 of the easy listening charts, which kind of seemed strange to me from a short space of a few years. I'd gone from being rock and roll and hard rock and all that to easy listening, but things had changed so much in the intervening years that's what it was determined as being.
During the period when you weren't performing or recording much, did you still play at home a lot, practice?
Yeah, and I got into producing records. I produced Phil Everly's first solo album for RCA Victor and a few other things. I've worked with Jimmy Bowen quite a bit to learn how to produce, and got into music publishing a little bit to learn how that worked, and started learning more of the business side of the business instead of just being an artist.
Your new album is your first album in America in a long time. Does this represent a new turn in your career?
Well, one hopes so. It's certainly new product, and out on Capitol Records, and I don't think they know what to do with it being an instrumental album. It's kind of left field for them.
A couple of the songs on the new album are in a minor key and have this mysterious sound to them that really almost reminds me of certain TV themes, westerns or spy shows, and I wonder if you feel that way too.
Yeah, I think most everything on the album could fit as a theme for some TV show or movie. We called it one song Jeff Lynne wrote called the theme for something really important, because we couldn't come up with a title. We thought of all these grand titles and thought it was a bit too pompous sounding, so we just decided to, instead of title it, to describe it.
must have, over the years, heard many guitarists who obviously patterned their sound on yours. And I wonder what you think about when you hear that.
I'm really knocked out when I hear that. Got me through a lot of lean years when I thought everybody had forgotten about me and things weren't going very well and all that sort of thing that happens to people. And it happened to me. And then all of a sudden I turn on the radio and hear somebody doing my sound. And I thought, hey, great, this is wonderful. Haven't been forgotten. And so it was a great source of happiness to me.
You're living in Nashville now.
Yeah.
Is that because it's one of the centers of the record industry, or are there other reasons that brought you there?
Well, there are other reasons. My daughter was here, and I also looked in my phone book and realized I knew more people in Nashville than I did in Lake Tahoe and California and several other places put together. So, but the main reason was, of course, to come down and see if I could maybe produce some country records and get into production and perhaps maybe do some recording as well. It's a lot has happened since I've moved here. None of it came from Nashville yet, but I'm sure it will.
Well, I wish you the best with your new album, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Duane Eddy's new album is on Capitol Records. He spoke to us from public radio station WPLN in Nashville. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
We're following the oil slick, which is approaching Wheeling, West Virginia. Also, a survey, a public opinion poll released in Warsaw, which shows that the vast majority of the Polish people, at least as of November, thought there was a possibility of a great social unrest there. Also, a report from Ann Cooper in Moscow about the renovation of a lot of Russian Orthodox churches, and a report from Deborah Amos on Israel's Arabs in the season of protest and violence in the occupied territories.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Raw, Eddie Murphy's first theatrical concert film. It was directed by Robert Townsend, who made and starred in Hollywood Shuffle, and it was released at the end of a year when Murphy had the number one grossing film, Beverly Hills Cop 2.
From Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy to Richard Pryor and Woody Allen, movie comics have always reflected the most deeply vulnerable parts of ourselves. Their world is like a more precarious version of our own, and their triumphs are wonderfully satisfying. If dupes and loonies like them can win in the end, well, certainly so can we. That's why the phenomenon of Eddie Murphy fascinates me so. He's the first hugely popular American movie comedian whose comedy is based on being invulnerable, on being better than his audience in every way. His hit movies are all about how he outwits everyone around him, how he cons his way into places he's not supposed to go. And in his abrasive new movie, Raw, which is about as badly shot and directed a concert film as I've ever seen, Murphy introduces himself as a genius, a superstar, a god. We hear his fans tell us he's the greatest thing since Velveeta, and then the stage lights come on and Eddie struts his stuff. He does a couple of impressions, and sure enough, they're devastating. Here, for instance, is Bill Cosby telling him he should clean up his stage act.
You cannot say filth, flarn, filth, flarn, filth in front of people.
And I said, I never said no filth, flarn, filth. He says, you know what I'm talking about. I can't use the type of language that you use, but you know what I mean when I say filth, flarn, 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 filth. And I said, I never said no filth, flarn, filth, and I don't know what you're talking about. I'm offended that you call f*** you.
But though his impressions of Cosby and Richard Pryor are spot on, they don't feel like homages. They feel like demonstrations of the new black comedy king's power. Not only can he do his own stuff, he can also do everything those old guys do, too. Then he launches into his real subject, the battle of the sexes, which for him can never end.
And I'm bringing home and lock up in the house. You go off to Africa and get you a bush woman, you can't let her mingle with American women. American women stick together. Last thing they want to see is you got some trained bush bitch in your house. They will catch her by herself in the kitchen and throw a monkey wrench in your whole program. As soon as they get alone, they'll be like, I can't stand it. We be running behind him doing everything he tell you to do. Who you think he is? You ain't no God. You a human being.
Murphy's troubles with the opposite sex aren't about the day-to-day frustrations and misunderstandings we all have. No, his big problem with women is alimony. He tells us that what keeps him from a lasting relationship is the possibility that after the inevitable breakup, his beloved will take half of what he owns. It's not the kind of conundrum most of his audience can share. It's the kind aristocrats and tycoons and monarchs have, a sign of Eddie's lordliness. It's lonely at the top, Eddie counsels. From up here, you can see that everybody's out to get you, to take you for all you're worth. His message, delivered with an impish self-satisfaction, is essentially this. See that person next to you? That person not only hates you, but is betraying you daily, right under your nose. Men and women hate each other, and whites and blacks, and gays and straights, and God, you should see those Italians. Small wonder that fights have broken out during and after showings of the movie. Murphy's idea of a good time is to play puppeteer, or Iago, with his fans, to set them against each other and then to sit back chortling in that strange hee-haw of his. Some of this stuff is funny, and the audience howls, but what are they howling at? Watching him work his crowd is a little like watching Father Coughlin or Billy Sunday or some other hate-monger rousing the powerless. Whatever he is in movies like Beverly Hills Cop, Eddie Murphy in concert is the demagogue of comedy.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we'll feature another in our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. I'll speak with language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg. Also, country blues guitarist Moses Rasko will perform a few songs, and Ken Tucker will review a new home video release of the 1946 film The Harvey Girls, starring Judy Garland and Ray Bolger. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.